Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection between food and grief, with your hosts, Sara Tangora
and Bobby Conforto.
On this show, we're going to really explore where grief and food intersect, how they go hand in hand, different people's experiences with their specific traumas and how food played a part from the beginning to the end of that experience.
And how as individuals, we uniquely process life's traumas and losses through either the longing for, the creating of, the avoiding of, the obsessing over, and the eating of food.
I remember right after Michael died, I still miss him, but I missed him so badly that night that I stopped at the convenience store on the corner and I bought a container of Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia. It's too sweet, you know, it's too everything. And I went home with it and I took it to bed. And I thought to myself, gee, so this is my first menage a trois after Michael's death. Me, Ben, and Jerry. And I ate the entire thing.
What do you think your relationship to food was during times of crisis?
I think that my sister and I use food to reward ourselves.
I wish I had something more interesting to say, but definitely like spaghetti and meatballs and chocolate cake.
My mom still can't eat Rugola. It makes her too sad.
I've also experienced a lot of loss, as has Bobby. And I think we really wanted to find a way where we could like work together. There's something that feels very compelling about doing a project with you, Mom, as just kind of a missing piece in life and just something we've always wanted to do but not known quite how.
Can't think of anything better myself.
I think that, I mean, any conversation about grief, I think, prepares everyone for grief because there are so few conversations about grief. It's why I think that what you guys are doing is so important.
This episode is presented by Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, an advocacy and action nonprofit created by and for restaurant workers. Learn more at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And who ever thought that a video series about watching an old Italian grandmother's making pasta will become hugely successful. It's got its own YouTube channel. It is a YouTube channel. Pasta Grannies. I'm sure you've caught sight of it or at least heard it about. Well, producer, director, creator, food writer Vicki Bennison saw something special and spent over 6 years filming and interviewing the women who became pasta grannies. Traditional regional recipes and techniques will be preserved thanks to her foresight and work. Because truly, pasta grannies is about so much more than an Italian nonna making fresh pasta. And now there is a companion cookbook that shares not only the recipes, but also the extraordinary stories of these endearing women. And I am so pleased that the creator of the series, Vicki Bennison, is here in the studio with me to share the behind-the-scene tales. Vicki spent many years working in international development in places like Siberia, South Africa, and Turkmenistan.
Yep.
And as she said, the next decent meal was always on her mind. So she began writing about her culinary adventures. From mushroom hunting with the Russian mafia to cooking zebra in Kenya. She is the author of A Taste of a Place and co-wrote seasonal Spanish food with Jose Pizarro. She and her husband split their time between London and Le Marche in Italy. Welcome, Vicky.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
As I said, this is truly an incredible and invaluable cookbook because it has now, well, not the cookbook alone, but the videos themselves, have locked in these treasures of old recipes, old techniques, and the stories in the book. What is so nice in the book is that you get to read the stories about these beautiful women, this wonderful woman. But what? Tell me a little bit about what led you to do this.
Well, I was researching another book, which never saw the light of day, and in that process, noticed that it was only old women who were making pasta on a daily basis. And they're the last of that kind. You know, for everyone younger than about 75, it's a choice. And I thought, let's celebrate them. And so I started filming them because pasta making is such a physical process that words don't do enough. And so it gradually came into being as a YouTube channel. The algorithms of YouTube eventually got their tentacles into me, and now I actually upload every Friday. But yes, that's how it started, kind of gradually. And I wanted to also just celebrate older women. I felt that there are loads of lovely celebrity chefs and things, and they're always saying, oh, you know, my mother or my grandmother, you know, they're my inspiration, but we never see them. Right. And so I thought, yeah, there's space for that.
Well, and as we spoke a little bit before the show,
yeah,
it's a dying breed because those people, the women who are now grandmothers, they all rode the wave of, well, there are economic times, you know, reasons for that too, but of women going back to work, and they're not at home cooking.
No. I think it was important for women to actually demonstrate that they could do more than cooking, and so that's why it got left behind a bit. But I think for younger women, our core audience is in fact 25 to 35 year olds, and they're discovering that actually you can do both. You can have a career and love food and actually discover traditions through that food.
Yeah. Well, certainly these... spending time with these grannies, yeah, working with flour and eggs and dough in their hands, a lot tamer than cooking zebra in Kenya hanging out with the Russian mafia.
Yes, but it's just as interesting. It is an everyday adventure, if you like, and I love every one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what I'm curious about, and I know you've talked about this with other people that you've been interviewed by, and is the process. How, I mean, you just don't go approach somebody on the street and say, hey, will you cook for me?
Yes, we do.
Oh, okay. Well, walk me through that process a little bit and tell me. You do have a charming story about the first granny that you ever filmed, but so why don't you share that and talk about the process a little bit?
I'll start with Livia, who's my granny finder.
Your granny wrangler, huh?
I do have a granny wrangler, Livia from Faenza, because to close the deal, if you like, you need an Italian, even though I speak Italian. She has been known to stand on Neapolitan street corners and say, will you cook? But that is not our only method. We rely on word of mouth and friends of friends, and also organizers of food festivals, which are called Sagra, in Italy, and they recommend people, and so that's how we find them. Also, you know, through the local town hall, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So there are sort of several ways. You know, for example, we're off to Trentino in a couple of weeks' time, and there we're kind of working with people who, more generally, you know, in craft kind of ways, have associations, and you know, the older women will make pasta in that, so we kind of got recommendations through them. So it's all quite interesting.
Well, there is that stereotype, and I think it really is more Italian than any other culture, but that stereotype of, you know, the old mama, now it's a grandma, but the Italian mama standing in the kitchen stirring the pot of sauce forever and ever. And as I say, that's, you know, that is dying out, and it's not, it's a stereotype that a lot of people didn't want to continue, but it, you know, it, it is, these women are, they're very ordinary women in they cook for their family. They share the love. I mean, not, I don't mean ordinary in a, you know, in a bad way, but because they all have extraordinary stories about where they, how they arrived at this point. But they're just ordinary women who, you know, cooked for their families, and now they're continuing this for you.
Very much so. I mean, they're very happy to share their experience, and they're surprised that people are asking. I mean, sometimes husbands come in from the fields to watch it happening because they can't quite believe the equivalent of baked beans is being filmed.
Yeah, right.
Because they've taken it entirely for granted until that point. So that's one thing, you know, that they're surprised. They'll say, oh, you know, my daughter isn't interested, so I'm very pleased that you are. That's one thing. And I think that myth of the nonna, I mean, she is central to Italian family life. And it's just, I think that will continue. It's just that in 20 years' time, what nonna will be cooking isn't going to be handmade pasta, which is, has right. been the case.
Right.
So that, that was a sort of one of the motivations for filming them.
Right, yeah, cultures and food evolve and, and things change.
Yes.
It would be... and. It would be a sorry thing to see that go away. However, pasta was not always as universal throughout the country as it is now either. And you, I mean, you've traveled around a lot and obviously been so involved with pasta. I'm sure you've learned quite a bit about pasta and its history. And you share a little bit of the background of pasta and how it sort of now has taken over.
I'm not a culinary historian like you, but what I have learned through friends as well who are in that field is that Ada Boney, a writer back in the 1930s, did a lot to use pasta as a unifying kind of food ingredient to bring Italy together. And, you know, so the sort of terms for pasta have changed. It was macaroni and things like that. Yeah. So that's one interesting aspect of it. And the other is that actually pasta quite often was a celebratory food. You couldn't always eat it every day. It was one of those Sunday foods and celebratory foods. I mean, particularly the tortellinis and things which take time to make.
Right, right.
So there's that aspect of pasta. And then you have all the migration from south to north. So, you know, pasta has come north where there was polenta. But certainly, you know, when you think of northern Italy and Milan and Turin, those big cities and things, it's quite interesting that even so, even though there is polenta and there's rice that is eaten as a carbohydrate in those areas, you still get fascinating little pastas. And one of my favorites, it got me very excited, was called Pifazac, and it means baby's nappies. Because of the way that you close it.
It's
a kind
of
folded over into a kind of pleat. And, I mean, it's full of, you know, cheesy breadcrumbs and things, and you kind of douse it in butter. So it's a meatless thing. But I love discovering that. That's north of Lake Iseo. It's about one tiny spot that make that pasta.
And that's what the... I mean, obviously, the videos... highlight this, but the book, you know, you get to spend time. The videos are over quickly, and then in the book you get to spend time looking at the recipes and the stories of the people and identifying again, reminding me, okay, where does she come from? Where are you filming this? And I know a lot about Italy and a lot about pasta and a lot about the culture, but there are types of pastas, names of pastas, I have never heard of. I mean, it truly is. Well, the cuisine in general is very regional, And I'm sure with all your travels, you have found this to be, you know, remarkably so.
Yes, it's designed to confuse the non-Italian, oh. I think. When you're Italian, you're actually convinced that your own village is the only place that makes that pasta. Uh-huh. So that's fine.
The next door village makes it, just under a different name.
So my theory about that is that pasta making is often a group activity. It's when women come together for a good natter. You know, many hands make light work. And so you need to have consensus about what you're doing, the shape of it, because you can't all be doing your own thing, as it won't cook in the same rate. You will have your own dialect, which we know changes as you go around the hill. And so that's how pastas have ended up. You know, one shape will have several names, and then one name can apply to several pastas. And that kind of fries your brain getting around that. You can have sort of like the macaroni shape will have about five different names in, you know, a small area.
Right.
So there's all that kind of mapping that happens. So the way we go about it is, you know, we'll look for a pasta, but we're also looking for women. And so, as you say, it's the older the better. The wrinklier the better. I do have someone who wrote in saying, oh, my nonna is 104. And I'm going, oh, my word, how quickly can I get to Sardinia? You know?
Yeah. Well, I was impressed, and I was very pleased because I spent a lot of time in Sardinia, and I love the fact that you have so many recipes of women cooking pastas from Sardinia.
Yes.
And all very different. Very.
Very. I mean, that's extraordinary. I think it's because the women were left to their own devices while the men, their husbands, went off as shepherds and spent large amounts of time on the hillsides.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they had to invent all these pastas.
In your research obviously you find a nonna, but then I'm sure that you then start to do some research, and so you know a little something about what she's going to be doing.
Oh, yes, yeah.
How are you finding references... or are you finding references to the dishes, or are these pretty much their recipes and well-kept secrets, or...
Yes, I mean, what you find is that there quite often is an official recipe. Some association has got together and said this is the bolognese, the ragu from Bologna.
Right. Well, that's, of course, that's on the register now.
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, no one else cares.
Yeah.
You know, the cooks in the area all do minor tweaks to that. And, you know, so there's a broad consensus about what that recipe is. But every household has its own sort of minor tweaks. And it's the way their mother taught them, but it's also, you know, their son has grown up not to like garlic too much, so they'll knock back on that. And so that's how, you know, all these recipes sort of vary. And so I'm sort of careful to say, you know, this is Maria's recipe rather than the official recipe, you know, the laid down in stone.
Right. I notice that. Every recipe has the woman's name.
Yes.
To identify her, but yes, her variation on the recipe.
Yes, yeah. Mm.
I know it's one of my pet peeves when people talk about, well, this is an authentic dish. I'm saying, please don't use that word. I mean, who... Authentic to whom? You know,
yes.
To your grandmother or
yes.
my grandmother? You know?
Yeah. It's authentic to me.
That's right. I want to go through a couple of the special ones, but
yeah.
A lot of people think of, oh, it's just pasta and it's, you know, it all stems from, you know, Cucina Povera. But in fact, you know, there was a time way back when it, you know, they couldn't afford the wheat if they didn't live near a mill or didn't have their own.
Yeah.
Or certainly not the eggs. It wouldn't be an egg pasta, you know.
No. So that's quite recent, actually. You know, the one egg every 100 grams of flour. You know, if you were poor, you sold the eggs. If you could. So adding eggs is celebratory. So it's only in the last 50 years that that's been happening. You know, and so when you see tagliarini from Piemonte, for example, and they're saying, oh, add 20 egg yolks, I mean, that's only restaurants that do that. I mean, housewives are very much more frugal than that.
Right.
So that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That it's, and obviously then, you know, it, as you say, it's spread with migration of the workers going on. Well, and in other countries, certainly in America. Mm. We, you know, saw the migration primarily of Italians from the south, from Sicily yes. and Naples and below. So there was a lot of pasta coming over, but, you know, it was...
Oh, that's a certain type, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. a certain type. Or as you said, it was all called macaroni. But even in your book, there are so many types of macaroni. You know?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there any type that sort of, and I don't mean to spring this on you, but like that kind of took you by surprise or that was your favorite or, you know, particular story?
We've mentioned Sardinia. Absolutely. Every time I go there, I'm always amazed by how local they are. And I think the first time I went there with the Suzuku, which is the use of saffron and things, and how that came to pass, and these women are still wearing their traditional dress, for example, as a matter of course. There are still sort of 70-year-olds wandering around in these beautiful sort of aproned, full-skirted things. Yeah. And no different to what's in the museum. It's a wonderful thing, and it's not for tourists. So, you know, I think if you're a culinary historian, then you need to go to Sardinia.
Definitely.
Quite quickly.
Definitely, yeah. Well, in fact, one of my favorites out of the whole book, and it's hard to pick a favorite, is who is it? Cesaria, making the loriguitas.
Yes.
This, you have got to see the video, and you have got to look at the book to see these. They look, it's interesting, because once they're sauced, someone might say, well, it's sort of like a pasta ring, you know.
Okay.
These are very special.
They are.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
They're only made for All Saints Day. Traditionally, I mean, now they're eaten year round, but they're only made in a town called Morgongiore. And Cesaria, who is now 95 years old, has been making them every day, I think, for the last 80 years. And hers are particularly, you have to compare it to something like a hazelnut. I mean, you can see just how small and fine they are. And she is actually our most viewed nonna. She is globally famous.
So when we
went back...
I was thinking of posting her picture to advertise the show.
Yeah, when we went back, we showed her the video and said, you know, you're famous. And she thought it was hilarious. She laughed her head off. I mean, it's...
But to see these, I mean, they're... So she takes the tiniest strand of pasta.
So she takes the tiniest strand of pasta. She's rolled it out really thinly, and it's a durum wheat flour dough, so only water, no eggs. And then she wraps it twice around her fingers, and then, like winding a watch, you twiddle it, and you end up with this kind of twisted, it looks braided, hoop. And then you allow them to dry out on the most beautiful flat basket, so that's part of its charm as well. And traditionally, it was just, you know, in the absence of radio and television and all that kind of thing, it was just a way of women getting together and singing and entertaining themselves as they made this in preparation for...
And sharing gossip, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, all aiming for this celebratory meal on the 1st of November. And it was traditionally served with chicken, cockerels, because you only need one for a flock of hens. So all the surplus males were slaughtered and made into a ragu. And so that's how you have... I know everyone says, oh, you can't have pasta and chicken. Well, yes, you can. and so it's stewed in tomato sauce and things, and that's what you serve with your loriguitas.
Yeah. I mean, if you see these... I mean, I think I had a pair of earrings one time that looked like one of these.
Very much so.
Yeah. They're great filigree... Lace makers,
filigree jewelry, beautiful breads. They have very elaborate breads there. That's a book in itself, I think, the breads.
Mm-hmm. A project, I hear a project. Some of the other pasta. Oh, you know what I actually love the story of? And was
the Maria's Raschiatelli.
Yes.
Lucia's is very nice, too. We'll talk about that one. Raschiatelli. Tell us what a Raschiatelli is, because it's probably called something else in this country, you know, under another dialect. But she has a wonderful story about the size, a way to feed a lot of people quickly.
Dodi cheese. So Raschiatelli is a type of cavatelli, which is when you kind of roll your fingers across dough to create a kind of curve. And so her Raschiatelli are 3 fingers wide. And she says if you're in a hurry or you've got a lot of people to feed, you use all 10 fingers.
So you'd have like this giant loaf of bread. You
pretty much.
Bread again,
like so it looks like
bread.
A sort of pot of pea pod.
Right.
And it's very chunky. I mean, I'm not sure that it's the greatest pasta, but it gets people full. I mean, she's a farmer.
You can make a lot of it and have it on the table quickly.
Yes.
Something that I was really never aware of. Then Lucia, and this is all from the Basilicata region.
Yes, right? Yes. We had a very fertile group of...
I guess. recipes from there. and that's very far south, for those of you who aren't familiar.
Yes, Basilicata, in the arch of the foot.
Right. Mm. Lucia has a wonderful recipe and an ingredient that you rarely see, especially with pasta. And tell us about that.
So horseradish.
Yeah. Go figure.
You kind of would expect it up north, you know, on the borders with Austria and Germany. But actually, you do get horseradish, and it's served with the meat ragouts, and they think... that it came with the Albanians. There were a lot of Albanian refugees that came over a couple of centuries ago, bringing horseradish with them. So that's why it's there.
Of course, anyone who has a garden knows that you never plant horseradish. It just finds its way in your garden because once it's there, it spreads and you can't get rid of it.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's great. Great use for it.
Yes.
But that intrigued me.
So they grated over the meat.
And she cooks it and she makes a sauce with salami.
Yes.
And,
so sort of quite a fresh salami and you just stew it with tomatoes. And then the final act is to grate this horseradish over it. Yeah.
Now that's something that I think would take a lot of people by surprise.
Yeah.
I think it's wonderful. And quite a few of the women made sagne.
Yes.
Which I had never really even, I've never heard it called anything, seen it on different travels, but never heard it called a particular name. Can you describe really what it is?
Sagne retorte we're talking about.
The long... Twisted once and then kind of just folded over.
Yeah,
it's a big noodle.
It sort of sounds like a shortened version of lasagna, but it isn't. It's sagne.
Sagne.
Can also be called sagne retorte, which means turned. And so it's a kind of wide pappardelle-type ribbon of pasta, which you hold one end and roll the other end with your hand, so it twists, and then because the pasta doesn't actually roll evenly, you then turn it around and do the other, and then you've got a kind of halved, a kind of U shape of pasta, which conveniently stays like that when you boil it.
Yeah, and you rolled it a lot and cut it up, you'd have fusilli or something, but they just keep it in the long ribbon.
Yeah. So this pasta comes from Puglia.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wonderful. And something that is more, from the times of the poorer times, mm-hmm. and times of not having a lot, which one of the women serves it with breadcrumb dumplings.
Yes, right? Yes.
Which we have passatelle, which are breadcrumb pastas.
So that comes from the village in the immediate area of Santa Maria de Leuca, it's just a way of filling up people is to poach this cheesy dumpling in the tomato sauce that you've got, or you can deep fry them as well. And that kind of thing of double carb in using breadcrumbs also crops up in Abruzzo. Yeah, so it's funny how things kind of crop up in random places.
And it's amazing how over the years these recipes, I mean, they didn't really travel to the different regions, but they're there, but maybe in a different form.
Yes.
You know, very...
Yes, Shushela, the dumplings, I don't know that they've traveled at all, actually. I think people mostly kind of balk at the idea of having dumplings and pasta.
Yeah, it really took me by surprise when I read about that.
If you want to go down there in the summer, they also have a festival. And I think you can have them on their own without the pasta as well.
But, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many stories and so many more recipes to talk about. We will talk about some more of these things and your plans for more filming when we come back after a short break. So stay with us.
This episode is presented by Restaurant Workers Community Foundation, an advocacy and action nonprofit created by and for restaurant workers. RWCF addresses quality of life issues that disproportionately affect restaurant workers, such as wage fairness, gender equity, racial justice, immigrant rights, mental health, and substance abuse. Learn more about advocacy, grant making, and impact investing by RWCF at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Hi, we're back, and I am speaking with Vicki Bennison, the creator of the famous Pasta Grannies.
Yay.
The YouTube channel that went viral. I mean, it really did.
Yes, very much. Yeah. I mean, my husband tells the story of me coming down one morning saying, someone's hacked the YouTube channel. I've got to find out and stop it because it had gone up 10,000 overnight. And I thought something had gone wrong.
What, I mean, aside from the fact that they're just such endearing women and stories, what do you attribute that jump?
I think everybody loves pasta and they particularly love grandmothers. And I think it's a very positive and also soothing in a weird kind of way, watching these. I think people quite often write into me and say that they've binge-watched Pasta Grannies.
Oh, I'm definitely one of them.
Yes.
It's just, they're not very long. How about, what's the average length of your videos?
We've allowed them to get slightly longer. When I first started and I was using a tripod and terrified, they were about 2.5 minutes long. And now they're about, vary between about, 3.5 and 5 minutes long. We might experiment with slightly longer episodes if there's enough story to carry that extra length. We're not going to increase it just for the sake of it. So,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, what you're doing is very successful. I mean, you've captured the right interest point for people, and they want to see these women working with, the hands, and the hands are just remarkable.
The hands are remarkable.
Yeah, you could do a whole photo montage on just the different hands, right?
Yes.
But the women are also so very different. I mean, there's the similarity, once again, is that passion and love for the food and feeding their family. But some will be just, as you talked about, Cesare, old and wrinkled from head to toe. And then there are a couple others who are fully made up, and their hands or nails are manicured and even polished. Others who look like they could care less that you're there filming them, they vary in styles and personalities as all women do.
As everywhere, yes.
But they have this one thing in common, and that's that their passion for making pasta.
Yes. And I think it's for them, it's about putting love on the table. I think it's a way they are quite central to their family life. And although you don't see them very often, this is how, putting food on the table is such an important aspect when you've lived through food shortages and things, which was the case in the 1930s and through the war and things. So that's how they do it, through their food. So they don't just make pasta. I mean, they're great cooks generally. We got one Maria from Faenza who we went back to because she also makes pastries and all sorts of things. She's a very good cook generally. I think people I kind of relate to that, you know. And although I occasionally get people writing in saying, "My granny couldn't cook and loved the microwave as soon as it was invented," that's not the case in Italy. I think they're still quite the women we're filming quite often are kind of contadina, the sort of market gardeners
outside the city centers.
Yes,
yeah,
we don't. I have filmed in Torino, and there, you know, you instantly get more problems because you've ceased to have small communities and people are put in big blocks of flats and stuff and get lonely. And so there has to be sort of, there's this initiative to bring people together through pasta, which I think is rather lovely.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. And you do spend some time talking about some of the women's vegetable gardens and their, you know, their fruits and the different couple, not a lot of time spent, but the uses of pasta being a sweet as well in some instances, but not a lot. However, you know, initially that's pasta was served as a sweet.
Yes, I believe, you know, several centuries ago, people were less bothered about, you know, where they put sugar because sugar was, you know, your Lamborghini. It was just so expensive. Where flashing your wealth was to put sugar in something. So it didn't matter whether it was the pudding. It had to be, you know, it was just, it would turn up somewhere else. So if you could afford to put it in with your pasta, so much the better.
Well, now what I want to talk to you about is for the initiated and uninitiated in pasta making. Mm-hmm. I'm sure people are envisioning, okay, electric machine or even the hand cranking pasta machine. None of these women use a machine.
Yeah, we do film some that do. I mean, sometimes
Never mind. Take that back.
Yeah. So two things. One is sometimes they get too old and their shoulders, you know, can't cope with the Mattarello, the long rolling pin. It's quite a good workout if you're thinking of wanting to get fit. And the other thing is that I think increasing wealth, as you go further north, people increasingly use the macchinetta rather than in the south. You know, the pasta police aren't going to sort of criticize you if you do use a macchinetta. I personally think it's no quicker than using a board and pin. Because by the time you faffed around kind of folding it up and, you know, messing with the dial to get it thinner and things, you may as well just got a pin and rolled it out. Mm-hmm. And you don't even have to get a pin. You know, there are lots of rolling pin. There are lots of pastas that you just need to make the dough and then, you know, roll out the cavatelli with your pin. So, I mean, in the book, there are pastas for everybody. There's, you know, the Maria's Rascatelli that we've talked about. There's another great pasta, which children adore as well, is called Peachy.
They can make them themselves.
Yes, that's right. So that's handmade spaghetti, really. You just kind of make it's
like a kid playing with clay.
Exactly.
Just roll out a long snake, right?
Exactly.
Or skinny snake.
Yeah. That's pepper, and she has a kind of al aioni. It's sort of a sweet garlic sauce. So she puts, you know, a whole head in, I think, and sort of simmers it with tomato sauce. Mm. So that's very delicious. So there's sort of kind of lots of basic ones that you can do that with very little experience, you know.
But then there are certain utensils or that they need or they can't do without, and I'm sure a lot of them are their own making for cavatelli if they want ridged, you know, allargate.
You don't need a gnocchi board with the ridges. It's like a little paddle. You can also use a fork.
It's true. A lot of people roll it off the tines of
a
fork.
Yeah. So, you know, until quite recently, people didn't really have crockery. I love the story of polenta used to be put straight on the table.
Yes. Yeah. You can find a couple of restaurants who will still do that on a napkin. They'll put it on the board way down and then a napkin and then pour it out.
So there are lots of pastas that you don't actually need special implements for. You can, if you really want, for example, go and buy a troccoli, which is a ridged rolling pin that makes the same kind of pasta as you would get with using the katara. It's still a square spaghetti. Mm-hmm. But equally, you can just chop up your sfoglia and you get a very similar thing. And, you know, as a mouthfeel, it's pretty much the same. So, you know, it's there are lots of easy pastas to discover.
Yeah. Mm. Well, there's one that is just so... so elegant, the Lumachelle alla Duquesa. Yeah, alla Duquesa from Urbino area.
Yes.
That's, tell us about that.
Oh, this is a wonderful pasta because you add cinnamon to the dough. And originally it was only meant for aristocracy, in particular women who had given birth to the heir. Needed sustenance to keep them going through the after the you know the birth. So nuns in the Urbino area used to make this pasta, which
Cinnamon was expensive.
And so, cinnamon was very expensive. And so you put that in the dough, and then you go to all sorts of trouble. You roll it out and you cut it up, and then you kind of make these little tubes of pasta, which are ridged. You roll it along an old weaving comb to create the ridges, very fine ridges. So you end up with these tiny little tubes that are ridged, and then you poach them in chicken broth. And you serve it with the chicken innards, traditionally, because they were considered the most nutritional thing you could give a lactating mother. And so that was the dish.
It's such an elegant-looking little,
yes,
tiny ring or tube.
And you know, nowadays you just add Parmigiano rather than, chicken gizzards. Yes, so there's that. And in fact, if you're in a hurry, you could just roll out your pasta and cut up squares and put that into your chicken broth. And and the smell coming off your chicken stock is just delicious.
Excellent. There are some pastas that are made that we don't often hear about, and I'm sure this was during a time when people didn't have access to the wheat or to a mill, mm-hmm. made with different grains, such as farro or...
So
buckwheat.
So unless you actually grew your own wheat, in which case you got your mill, local mill, to come around every time you needed, they'll grind your own flour. With the wheat that you had supplied. So you always have very fresh wheat. And that's actually a comment that I get from older women is that the flour doesn't taste the same these days. It doesn't have that kind of sweet nuttiness that you get. So for those people who didn't grow their own wheat, you would have to find other ways of cutting that wheat to make it go further. So you can have chestnut flour you can add. You can add farro flour. And then there's the burnt wheat flour, the grano arso, that you get in Puglia, which is very specific. And that was from picking up all the leftover wheat after you'd burned the field after the harvest. And nowadays, that's done artificially in a factory.
It was scavenging, when it first came about. Now it's done intentionally.
Yes, right? Exactly. Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's now a thing.
When you film these women, you've made the you've gone in, you've had somebody introduce you, do the introductions, and spend time. They tell you what they're going to make. They have their recipe, they know what they want to make, and you say, go for it. Do you buy the ingredients for them? Do they say no? I mean, is there pride in that? There's a lot that goes into this agreement.
There is, yes. So we do buy their ingredients. Actually, what we try and do is pay them. We pay them, and it's quite a struggle sometimes. We have to kind of hide it on a mantelpiece somewhere sometimes, just because they're very proud, and actually when they're actually being hospitable to you. So the idea of us paying them is sometimes not something that they want. But so as a principle, we pay for the ingredients and their time.
Sure.
And so we do that. And to offset those one or two that we can't do that to, because we're causing offense if we have insisted, we also do charitable donations to offset that. So we're very keen that we're not for want of a bit better expression, you know, exploiting our grandmothers. Right. We're sort of cherishing them. So, for example, last year I waived my fee and I gave to charity because that people wanted some grandmothers. So I said, okay, well, what you're paying me, I'm giving to charity. So that's how we do it. Yeah.
Well, the other thing is that I'm sure, so you don't offend them, you have to eat what they've made.
Oh, look at the shape of me.
I'm sure sometimes you're not. Believe me, it doesn't show that you're eating that much. I would imagine that you film maybe a couple times a day, a couple different.
Yeah, sometimes we even manage to film four if they're all in the same area.
And you have to, if you don't eat, that is a total offense.
It is, of course, yes. So they're not thinking of YouTube. They're thinking of making a meal for us. Yeah. So we all sit down and have lunch at 9 in the morning, and we will repeat that several times during the day. And fortunately, our cameraman Andrea, you know, he can eat for 5, and he's very gorgeous, and all our grannies love him. So, you know, we get one spoonful and he gets 6. So he gets to eat the lion's share of what is made.
A tough job, but someone's got to do it, right?
He's slamming it, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Well, it is such a wonderful series, I applaud you for having the fortitude to go through with all this,
oh,
all these years,
it.
and giving us this treasure of recipes and to see the actual process of this being made, which, you know, may not continue, but maybe you will inspire a whole new group of pasta makers.
I hope so. Yes. No, and we're definitely not giving up.
So what's next? You got more up your sleeve? More pasta films up your sleeve?
Yes. More pasta films. Maybe going over into Croatia just to see what the grandmothers getting up to there. And also maybe going back to the grandmothers and seeing what else they have up their sleeve. So, mm-hmm. I'm often asked for dolce, what biscuits and biscotti they're making. I think that would be popular too. Mm-hmm. So anything that's cooked from scratch, really. That would be even more of a disaster for my waistline. I don't have a sweet tooth, so. More of the same, more lovely grannies are up our sleeve, yes.
Well, I look forward to seeing anything more that you do. I specifically want to thank you for the book because, you know, it's the videos are one thing. You know, you sit and you watch them and that's great and you get inspired. Yeah. But this book is something I can keep going back to and actually cook from it. And how many recipes are in here?
75.
Is that all? It just seems like it's so rich. It seems like there are more than that.
Well,
just,
I think there's definitely volume.
I mean,
not,
I don't mean that. That is that all? That's a lot, you know. But but it just it just seems like there are so many wonderful variations on a theme.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And we're always discovering there's so many more wonderful recipes out there. So. Watch this space.
Well, you have preserved these regional classics for us all, and I thank you for that. And I thank you for this wonderful series and for being here and spending your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio. A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends. And please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking.
We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.